Good morning. I'm Michael Fix, and I'm the president of the Migration Policy Institute. And I really want to thank you and welcome you to the Migration Policy Institute. Thank you for coming to this panel. It's going to be on our Jana Batalova's and my new report called PIAC, Assessment of the Competences of Adults in the United States. We, the two of us, think it's a very exciting report, but I hope we're not alone. This session is being live streamed, so when we get to questions and answers, would you please identify yourselves and your affiliation? And no matter how lively the conversation may get over the course of the session, we're going to have to end on time. I make moderator be aware. We have assembled an absolutely terrific and engaging panel for you this morning. You have their formidable biographies on your chair, or if you're following on your computer, but I'll just add a word about each of them for us. First, I'll introduce my estimable colleague, Jana Batalova, to my right. Jana is a demographer. She's a senior policy analyst, and she is by far our best-selling report writer here at the Migration Policy Institute. After we, Jana and I, present our paper this morning, we'll have commentaries, and the first commenter will be Demetra Smith Nightingale, sitting to Dimitri's left. Demetra holds the extremely august and challenging position of being the Chief Evaluation Officer of the Department of Labor in the Office of the Secretary, Tom Perez. Demetra is a former professor at Johns Hopkins University. She's been a senior fellow at the Urban Institute. And in the very dim mist of time, Demetra and I once led an evaluation of the implementation of the 1986 Immigration Reform and Control Act. And so this subject was and is close to her bone. And then following Demetra, we'll hear from, I'm delighted to say, we'll hear from Andy Van Coylen. He's the Chief Executive Officer of the National Skills Coalition here in Washington, which he founded. And the coalition is one of, if not the leading voice on the public workforce system in the United States and its reform. And it's one that is, I'm grateful to say, I think increasingly turning its interest and its influence to the nation's immigrant workers. Finally, I'll turn to Dimitri Papadimitriou, the founder and the President Emeritus of the Migration Policy Institute, and incidentally, a former director of the Bureau of International Labor Affairs at the Department of Labor. He chairs our Transatlantic Forum on Migration, and he is one of the world's leading experts on migration and on skills. And I am really glad to have been able to dragoon him into serving on this panel, both as a speaker and as the moderator. So with that, I think we'll turn to Jana's and my presentation of the paper. A way we're going to approach it is I'll say a few words about the imperatives for our study, our research questions, our findings, and of course the implications for future research and for policy. And to begin with, just in time, I want to say that we are extremely grateful to our colleagues at the American Institute for Research and to the Department of Education for giving us the opportunity to explore PIAC, to giving us the resources to be trained, to giving us access to the restricted data sample, and to be very, very patient and extremely acute reviewers of the document as it's proceeded. PIAC stands for the Program on International Assessment of Adult Competencies. And in particular, what it allows us to do is to look at the first and the second generation of immigrants in working in the United States. So let me turn to the imperatives of the of the study. The first is obvious, and it's demographic. The immigrant population quadruples in the United States between 1970 and 2013, from about 10 to 40 million. Immigrants are overrepresented in the U.S. labor force. They're 1 in 8 U.S. residents, but they're 1 in 6 workers in the U.S. economy. Almost all demographers assume that virtually all net growth in workers will come from the immigrant populations. So the workers that are walking into the new jobs in this reviving economy, thank you, the Department of Labor, will be replacing older workers who will be leaving that economy. Some of those older workers are actually on this panel today. Another imperative for this work, and this is, I think, more of a finding, lies in the fact that immigrants have been so widely reported to be overrepresented among adults with low skills in the PF. Excuse me. So while we see that immigrants are 15% of the PX sample, they make up 33% of adults with low English literacy skills, and they're 24% of respondents with low numeracy skills. So moving next. So what is PIAC? It's been called, and I think this may be true, the largest, most innovative survey of adults ever taken. It involved 24 countries, OECD countries. It included 166,000 respondents. 5,000 of them were in the United States. 15% of the U.S. sample were first-generation immigrants, that is to say, immigrants born in adults born in the United States. 9% were second-generation, that is to say, U.S.-born adults with one or more foreign-born parents. Let's see. And here we are. Excuse me one second. I have... So the PIAC is a unquestionably a researcher's dream. It offers a background sample which gets into the demographics, which in a very deep way of each respondent. The background sample was given in Spanish and in English. It took typically 45 minutes to fill out, more than we almost ever get in our research projects. And what it does is it not only provides this extraordinary background on each of the 166,000 respondents, it also, and here we have another researcher's dream, it directly assesses literacy, numeracy, and computer use skills. But I might add, it does so in English. Let me say, as before I set sail into some of the mixed but I think disheartening results of immigrants on the PIAC, let me set the results in a broader context of what I think are the more purely disheartening results for the overall U.S. population. In brief, what we see and what we're told is that U.S. average scores in all three of the domains that were tested, in literacy, in numeracy, and in computer skills, lagged the OECD averages. In numeracy, the domain that we are told is the best predictor of income, the U.S. adult population 16 to 65 scored above only Italy and Spain. And for the millennial population, 16 to 34, U.S. scores were the lowest of all the OECD countries. Further, if we look at PIAC's forerunners, such as the adult literacy and skills summary, we can see that there has been no improvement over time in literacy, and we see an actual decline in tested results for numeracy. Another distressing fact is the fact that the U.S. does have some areas where they do lead the OECD, and that they lead the OECD in the size of the gap between the scores of the 90th percentile taking the test and those at in the 10th percentile taking the test. And this finding, I think, suggests, to the next slide, please, the relationship between skills acquisition to the kind of inequality that is very much in the public debate today, and that I think our PIAAC analysis of the U.S. population as a whole rather deeply reinforces. And it reinforces an understanding that skills are, of course, directly related to whether you get employment. They are directly related to the earnings of workers at every single level of education. Skills, to a striking degree, are related to health in the United States, and we find that the higher skilled workers in find themselves in jobs that themselves provide upskilling. Let me put this differently. Skills beget skills. That pushes some workers ahead and leaves some behind, reinforcing the kinds of inequality that I think are very much in the debate today and that I hope our speakers will be able to say a few words about. So let me turn now and try to tee up Jana's presentation of our findings and just say a few words about the research questions that this largely descriptive study addressed. And as you'll see, they lie at the intersection of a number of different areas, a number of different literatures. They lie at the intersection of immigrant integration, of labor policy, of education policy, and, you know, very important to us at the Migration Policy Institute, immigrant selection policy. And as I say, they'll be picked up in Jana's presentation. So some of the questions that we addressed were, how do the skills of immigrants compare to natives? How do they vary by race? How do they vary by ethnicity? How do skills vary? And this is where the PIAAC is fantastic. How do the skills of immigrants vary across generation, from the first generation to the 1.5 generation, that is to say, immigrants who came before they were 13, to the second generation? Do we see here, as we see in so many domains of immigrant integration, substantial intergenerational progress? Another question they asked is, to what extent do low overall U.S. skills, this low overall U.S. skills that I just talked about, to what extent can they be laid at the doorstep of immigrant respondents to the PIAAC? This was a question we came to late in our analysis, and we, I think, have come up with a fairly provocative response to that. We asked the question, how do immigrant skills vary by place of education? That's whether they're foreign or U.S. educated. Our own research in the past has found out that place of education is a very big predictor of income and mobility. And then the final question, which we asked more questions than this, but the final question I'll mention here today is, how do immigrant skills relate to their labor market access and incomes? And in particular, the question that we're going to ask here is, how are low-skill immigrants more likely to be employed in the U.S. economy than their native counterparts? Another question we're asking in future research is, are low-skill immigrants more likely to be employed in the United States than they are in other OECD countries? And here again, I think we have a fairly interesting response. So I'll now turn the floor over to Jana, and I will turn the moderating responsibilities over to Dimitri, and I hope to have a nice, entertaining hour ahead of me.
All right. Well, thank you, Mike. The fellow researchers, I can be as nerdy as I want in describing the results. So the results can be described in two ways, as average scores on a continuum from 0 to 500, and the 275 point was set up as a cutoff point for proficiency. You'll hear about it later. And the second way is the share of adults who scored at a particular proficiency level. Each level summarizes what a person with a certain score can do. PIAAC reports six levels, ranging from below level 1 to level 5. And just give you an example on literacy, for instance, the skills range from an ability to read a simple short text and identify a single piece of information that will be below level 1 ability to the ability to integrate and evaluate information from multiple dense texts, which will be a level 5. We combine these six levels that PIAAC reports into three and call them low, basic, and proficient levels. All right, so now back to our findings. This figure shows a significant variation in skills by race, ethnicity, and nativity. It highlights three salient patterns. One is that Asian and white adults, regardless of their immigrant status, outscored their Black and Hispanic counterparts. Among both white and Black adults, proficiency levels of immigrants are and natives are very similar, which is not the case among the Hispanic and Asian adults. For these latter two groups, the immigrant literacy lag those of natives. So for instance, if we look at the Hispanic population, 62% of Hispanic immigrants scored at low level, and that number drops to 24% among the native-born Hispanics. For the Asian population, 42% score at proficient level, and that number rises to 63% among the U.S.-born Hispanics. And so these patterns suggest a kind of intergenerational progress that Michael mentioned, at least among Hispanics and Asians. The future of the U.S. economy will depend in large measure on the skills of the incoming generation of workers. And PIAAC allows us to look at the skills of adults by age. So the comparison of the literacy score in this case of incoming workers, those aged 16 to 26, and those on the verge of retirement, 55 to 65, shows that the literacy skills of young native adults were just marginally better than the skills of the older native workers. That's not the case among the immigrant population. We see that whereas only 30% of the immigrant older adults scored proficient, that number rose to 30% for the younger immigrants, which suggests some improvement in the skills of the labor force replacement population among immigrants. Since the PIAAC assessment is essentially an assessment of skills, literacy, and numeracy in English, one would expect that immigrants who are recent arrivals would have lower skills in English than those who lived in the country for a while and had the greater exposure to English. What's interesting about this figure is that it shows no difference in the literacy and also numeracy skills of immigrants by time of arrival. One possible explanation for that is that that we find that there is a higher proportion of advanced degree holders among those who arrived in the period between 2007 and 2011, which we think that factors such as a tighter U.S. labor market, the improving Mexican economy, and the related decline in unauthorized migration likely contributed to the rise in human capital of the later, the post-recession migration flows to the United States. So moving on to the relationship between education and competencies. And this chart demonstrates there is a strong relationship between formal degrees and skills. On both literacy and numeracy assessments, the higher the formal educational attainment, the higher the average scores. However, formal educational attainment does not fully explain the adult skills. This figure shows, for instance, that regardless of nativity, adults with a high school degree and even those with an associate degree are not reaching proficiency level. And there is also a large gap in the average literacy scores between immigrants and natives across all levels of education, although this gap narrows for those with advanced degrees. We also find that even among the native population, 13% of advanced degree holders and 22% of those with bachelor's degrees score below proficient on literacy, and even higher shares score below proficient on numeracy. Among immigrants, these shares are even higher. This result may partially explain the comparatively high levels of underemployment that we find in our other research that affects college-educated immigrants in the United States. We also find that place of education matters. Immigrants with U.S. degrees scored 26 points higher on literacy and 30 points higher on numeracy than immigrants with foreign earned education. At the same time, immigrants with U.S. degrees, their average scores approximate the those of U.S.-born counterparts on both literacy and numeracy assessment. We find that 59% of PIAAC respondents, PIAAC immigrant respondents, earned their highest degree in the United States, their highest college education in the, among the college educated immigrants. 59% earned their degrees in the United States, which is a good news because as our own and other research demonstrates, having a U.S. degree boosts immigrants' opportunities for better employment and higher wages. So we talk a lot about intergenerational progress, and let me just show you quickly a slide that demonstrates that. We have a mixed bag story to report here. The good news is that there is a steady progression in proficiency across generations. Whereas only 24% of immigrants who came before age 13, which is our first generation bar on the slide, scored at proficiency in English. That number rises to 37% among immigrants who came as children before age 13, and even further to 51% for U.S.-born children from immigrant families, or rather U.S.-born adults from immigrant families. And what's also important is that the literacy levels of the second generation are nearly the same as the third generation, so the U.S. U.S.-born adults from U.S. U.S.-born families. The not-so-good story here is that the proficiency levels of the second and third generation levels are relatively low by international standards. I will now switch gears and discuss the relationship between skills and economic outcomes. And we find that higher literacy and numeracy skills meant higher rates of employment for natives. However, employment of among immigrants did not differ statistically by proficiency level. And what Michael mentioned earlier, that what's one of the very interesting findings of ours was that the immigrants with the lowest proficiency on literacy and numeracy levels were employed at a higher rate than similar native-born adults, 75% versus 59%. Unlike employment, however, literacy and numeracy scores mattered a great deal for earnings for both immigrants and natives. We find that on average, as adults' proficiency increased, so did their wages. Adults who were proficient on average earned $36,000 more per year than their low-skilled counterparts, which lends further evidence to what Michael mentioned earlier with regard to that the difference in skills is closely tied to economic inequality. How are we doing on time?
But go ahead.
Oh, okay. So I'm going to probably quickly go over the key takeaways, just that we are on the same page before I move to the implications. But so we find that immigrant scores are lower on a variety of dimensions than those of natives. We do find the substantial intergenerational progress, however. We find that immigrants were overrepresented among the low-skilled adults. But if we take the foreign-born, the skills of the foreign-borns out of the calculation of the U.S. national average, in both literacy and numeracy, we see that the scores increase just marginally by 5% point, and they're still lower than the proficiency cutoff score, and they're lower than the OECD averages. We find significant differences in literacy and numeracy scores by race, ethnicity, and nativity. We find that younger immigrants had stronger skills than older immigrants. On the other hand, we don't find any variation by the period of arrival. Skills rise with formal education, and the place of education matters. And while immigrants can find jobs regardless of their proficiency level, they need stronger skills to earn on par with natives. All right. So our findings that immigrants have high rates of employment they suggest that workplace can be an ideal place to provide additional training, not only because it contextualizes the skills, but also because work-based language and workforce training reduces competing pressures and logistic hurdles that often serve as a barrier for immigrants in improving their skills. There is also an urgent need, as our results demonstrated, to provide language instruction and workforce training to adults with low skills of education. However, our finding that a significant share of college-educated immigrants who score at low proficiency level points to an often overlooked finding that language and literacy services have to be made available across all educational levels. And finally, we think that a number of our PIAAC findings will be relevant to the newly created White House Task Force on New Americans. In particular, our finding that immigrants with foreign earned degrees are more likely to have low English proficiency, and that proficiency, those levels translate to poorer labor market outcomes, underscore the need for a coordinated federal, state, and other initiatives to improve the skills of these highly educated immigrants if we were to maximize the use of the human capital that these immigrants bring. And finally, as good researchers, we always look forward to doing more research. And our next topic is the second generation and how and their skills across five countries, the United States, Canada, Germany, France, and the United Kingdom. They have a significant or growing second generation population, and we are very interested in exploring PIAAC to understand the skills, especially of the 16 to 34 population, because these are either in the labor force pipeline or just entered the workforce, and this group is more likely to have receiving the services will be most beneficial for improving their workforce preparedness, and thus will have direct impact on economic productivity. So please mark your calendars to attend our next paper release sometime in the future. but for those interested in PIAAC research already done, I should say that we will find some of the best research papers done from a recent conference organized by our colleagues at the American Institutes for Research, and you can find these papers at PIAAC.gateway.com. Thank you.
Thank you, Jana. And now this is going to be a test at the end of this, you know, event. You're going to have learned that Demetra is the person on my left. Dimitri is the person to her right. It's a test. We'll see whether you pass. Demetra, why don't you go?
Thank you very much. I'm really very glad to be here today. And we are at the Labor Department. We're looking to PIAAC and to the ongoing analysis of PIAAC by MPI, as well as all of you in the room, and continuing to build the great nuggets of information that come out of the PIAAC survey. And a couple of things I just wanted to react to, and again, some of the main findings that you've already heard of that I had thought were particularly important looking at the PIAAC results from an immigrant lens. One is the issue of the, we know that those of you who've been involved in some other PIAAC conferences, we know that the U.S. results do not look as good as what we might like. But I think what we are learning from the very nice MPI report is that there is a continuing trend of inequality and gaps that are based on race, and not only on race and ethnicity, but on immigrant status and arrival. So the particular issue there that I think we need to focus on from a policy and program perspective is the gap for Hispanic and blacks, particularly the severe gap for those Hispanic and black foreign-born. The second is the literacy gap, in particular for immigrants compared to the native-born, and the importance of higher education and formal education on improving, or the correlation to higher numeracy and higher literacy, and the combined effect of those on subsequent earnings. And one issue that many of us have looked at for a number of years is understanding the importance and the reality of very high employment rates among immigrants, not surprisingly, and that we in the policy and program world need to capitalize on that. That's a strength, not a weakness. The weakness is that their wages are low, but by understanding that the employment rates are high regardless of literacy and numeracy skills is an important place where we can start. It should be the floor, not the goal. And I'll talk about that in a minute. And both of those issues around sort of the ongoing disparity by race and immigrant status, and employment, the high employment among immigrants, and yet the continuing gap in literacy and numeracy for the foreign-born provides to me the direction that we perhaps need to focus on to improve the situation and focus on those with limited proficiency in English. I wanted to tell you a little bit about how we hope that some of what is going on in at the national level will provide an opportunity to do that. And as some of you know, the new Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, WIOA, is replacing the old Workforce Investment Act, or WIA. And the key thing to remember about WIOA, and I know my colleague Andy will talk a little bit more about that, is both opportunity and innovation. And in looking at the PIAC results and hearing the wonderful comments that we've just heard, tying it all together, I want to focus on those two, opportunity and innovation. On opportunity, it's really what we're trying to do is improve the opportunity for all workers and all future workers, and expanding opportunity to improve skills through career pathways, apprenticeships, and to strengthen the opportunity to for all to have a pathway to the middle class. And as Janae said, one of the important points is sort of the workplace-based opportunities. And by having more of an emphasis, and under the WIOA, there's certainly the opportunity to emphasize more workplace-based training, more combination of work and training, because low-income and low-wage workers cannot usually very easily stop working to go into training or education. They need to continue to have the earnings there as well. So some of the high priority initiatives that we are encouraging and that the Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act supports are some of those strategies, including high quality career pathways training, apprenticeship, particularly at the Labor Department, we particularly have strong evidence of the importance of registered apprenticeship done in combination between the federal government, the industries, unions, and training institutions. The work-based training, such as on-the-job training, subsidized training, that combines an income source with training in the workplace. So we think that the opportunity message from WIOA is very strong, and it is about one of the words we use is upskilling. It's for providing opportunity, especially for those who've not had opportunity, which would, I hope, include a lot of foreign-born and their families, because it's not just the immediate generation, but the second and sometimes third generation immigrants who need the extra support. Innovation in the WIOA is a clear emphasis from Congress, from the White House, to emphasize improving the entire system of training and education from the federal level on down. That includes both streamlining the programs and the funding, and aligning sort of both the eligibility and the accountability for related programs that in many times in history, they've gone off in different directions. So right now there is more of an emphasis on alignment and collaboration across the systems than I've seen in the 40 years that I've been looking at these programs. So it's really in the alignment, the Education Department, Department of Labor, Health and Human Services, the Small Business Administration, and HUD and others, Department of Justice, are all, and Department of Commerce, are all working together in real partnership. Sometimes people ask me if the collaboration and partnership is real or not. It is real. We have a clear mandate from the White House to collaborate, to eliminate duplication where we can, to align policies and procedures, to eliminate the red tape wherever we can do that, and to blend the availability of resources. Certainly for the foreign-born, that kind of focus on innovation and collaboration, we hope, will allow for an increased emphasis on the population that we're looking at here. A couple of just quick points on how I think, listening to what we've heard, how that might happen. One is, well, I have to say that because of my job, which is looking at research and figuring out what works and making sure that the public and policymakers know that, there is a very strong emphasis on innovative program adoption in the WIOA and a continuing emphasis on evaluation, which those of us who are evaluators, we like to see that kind of support. So it is the kinds of things that we do have some evidence of promise that could improve the situation for low English competency individuals, particularly and including those who are foreign-born. One is accelerated learning, because as we've heard, obtaining a degree is in and of itself not enough, and perhaps accelerating the learning so that the cost and the burden on the individuals and their families is reduced. We have some evidence that accelerated learning opportunities can improve the educational outcomes. Integration of basic occupation training with English and ESL. There are a lot of models around the country that are doing that, and we're trying to encourage continued integrated approaches where the English and basic skills are combined with real occupational training and hopefully credentials when that's possible. Registered apprenticeship, as I also mentioned, we have some strong evidence that registered apprenticeship, people who go through registered apprenticeship have lifetime earnings of about over $250,000 more in their career than those who do not. And then fourth, which we haven't heard very much about yet, but I would emphasize, is youth opportunity. And we know that often for young people, and this may be particularly important for those in the second and third generations, the first career exposure, the first work exposure that young people have sort of sets the track for their career in a lifetime. We need to do more to make sure that that initial experience is positive, whether it's through high-quality summer jobs programs, combined internships for high school students, better, smoother, and cheaper transitions from high school into college, including free community college, where we can have that, is also important. And the one thing that those of you who are working with states, one way that, that these kinds of realignments could occur, one is that there is a in the WIOA a requirement that a certain percentage of the adult ed money should be devoted to English literacy and civic education. So having that set aside in the law, I think, is an important step in the right direction. The second is that all states have to have a single state plan for the workforce programs for adult ed, including English and literacy and vocational and career technical education. So having that integrated plan, there should be some leverage at the state level to make sure that it also includes some of the innovations for the foreign-born population. And then common measures across all these programs. The agencies and the departments are working very hard to come up with aligned and reasonable measures that would apply to the various programs. So I really thank you for all the work that you've done, and particularly for highlighting some of the areas where immigrants may be doing as well as the native-born, but helping us to dig through that and find where there are particular things that we can focus on more. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Dimitra. Andy,
thank
floor
you.
Is yours.
Good morning, everyone. So let me follow up on some of the things that Dimitra brought up. First of all, let me say thank you to MPI for this analysis and for the continuing attention that they have brought to these issues, particularly as they relate to skills and education and training and trying to get more of our immigrant workforce on a pathway towards legalization as well as good, well-paying jobs that's going to help them support themselves and their families. This is incredibly important work. I think, you know, acknowledgement also to the Office of Career Technical and Adult Education at the Department of Education for being the point on the PIAC study and for trying to bring, they're also trying to bring attention to some of these results. And great thanks to my colleague from the Department of Labor and the other agencies that are now working with the Department of Education. As Demetra said, the amount of interaction between the agencies now, I think, is pretty much unprecedented on a range of different skills issues, including these questions about how it is that we can help people with low basic skills, including immigrant workers, get on a pathway towards some kind of training that's going to get them into a long-term, well-paying career. So I think that we have a lot to be thankful for in that area. Obviously, the results are sobering, and you know, the fact that you know the percent where we rank in the terms of the rest of the world in terms of the low basic skills attainment within this country, the gaps with high skills attainment, the wage penalty that is associated with low skills attainment within this country, which is higher than in most other countries. You know, that is all something that we need to be figuring out what to do about that. And quite frankly, as a nation, what we do per capita for our adult workforce, ranks us pretty much toward the bottom of countries, at least the ones that were surveyed in the OECD survey. This has real implications for those individuals. It has real implications for our economy, as Michael said. You know, most of the growth in our workforce from now to mid-century, there's an estimate about 83% of that growth in the workforce is going to be immigrants and their children. And if we're not making investments in their skills, you know, the problems that employers are having now in finding people with the right skills for open jobs is only going to continue to increase with our retirements for a lot of skilled workers who are going to be leaving the workforce in the next several decades. And the changing economy, which, you know, the jobs that used to be accessible with a certain level of skill are now going to require a much higher level of competency, and it's going to be beyond not just the people that we've talked about here in this report, but even folks probably at a level two or so under the PIAAC study. So when you're talking about 36 million people at limited literacy skills, almost 60 million people at limited numeracy skills, it's the equivalent of almost 40% of our current workforce. That is a significant structural challenge that I think we need to take on in some significant way. So I think the good news here in Washington, and I won't go into because Demetra covered a lot of it in terms of the new legislation that's been passed, the WIOA legislation, and she's absolutely right. I think that, you know, if from our organization's perspective, the best investments in adult basic ed are typically those that are integrated with some kind of work experience or some kind of occupational training. The challenges that WIA had to bring the title that was focused on technical training together with the title that was focused on adult basic ed has been a long-standing challenge for how this program has operated since it was authorized in 1998. The new law does try to address some of those issues. Not all of the fixes are complete. We are putting a lot in the hands of the states to actually come up with how some of these things are going to be solved, and so I think we need to be paying attention in terms of how that's going to be implemented on the ground. The emphasis on career pathways, the authorization of the English Literacy and Civics Education Program, and the expectation that a certain amount of adult basic ed resources are going to be used for that program, I think those are all movements in the right direction. I also think, as Demetra mentioned a little bit about it, we have some exciting stuff that's happening outside of legislation in terms of what the administration has been willing to do on some of these issues, particularly over the past 2 years. In 2014, the president called for a government-wide review of all of our job training, adult ed, and career and tech ed programs. There was a job-driven training action plan that was released in the summer of last year, and it has been part of the reason why it is that we have so much now interagency interaction on some of these issues. There's an entire part of that report that was focused on upskilling. So this idea of how is it that we can get more investment into frontline workers with limited basic skills, including many of them who are immigrants, to give them an opportunity to advance to some kind of a better paying job. The president talked a little bit more about this after his most recent State of the Union address on a new set of initiatives challenging the business community and the labor community, you know, important private sector actors to talk about what they are doing to try to get more frontline workers access to skills and advancement. I think we want to see a strong partnership from the federal government in doing that moving forward as well. And many of the other things that Demetra focused on in terms of the increased focus on apprenticeship, the new resources that are going to be going out from the Department of Labor. There is going to be an attention to pre-apprenticeships, partnering with immigrant-serving organizations to be diversifying the number of people, the types of people who are going to be having access to apprenticeships that may have been excluded in the past. I think those are all very promising. Here are the challenges. You know, for one, our low ranking within the PIAAC, I believe, coming from somebody at a policy organization, it is because this has not been a policy priority historically in this country. You know, we are spending about right now in the area of about $570 million on adult basic ed through Title II of WIOA. That means that we're serving just under 2 million people at probably somewhere between $200 and $300 a person, a woefully inadequate level of investment. And unfortunately, although many skills programs have taken cuts over the past several years, dating back to 2010, workforce programs probably took about $1 billion worth of cuts with those past several years. And there have been some efforts to try to reverse some of those cuts moving forward. The investments in adult basic ed have really been flat. There's not really been any recapture of some of those cut funds. That $570 million is down from about $660 million from just a few years ago. So we're moving in the wrong direction in terms of investment. We're trying to address some of these issues. I do think we also just have to pay attention to the fact that immigrants have limited access to some of the services that we're already providing. And particularly if you value integrated education and training just within the context of WIOA. So Title I, which serves the technical training, provides the technical training services, has a different set of eligibility requirements than Title II, which are the adult basic ed and ESL services. If you do not have work authorization, you cannot access Title I services. So we have many people who currently cannot access that integrated education and training pathway. We've even had that challenge for the youth who have been protected under DACA, that even those who were in school or had a diploma who were work authorized, we found out that many of them were being turned away from our WIA system just because typically there was not an understanding on the ground that they had work authorization and entitled them to those services. The department has tried to fix that so that we're making sure that there's greater awareness on the ground. But we have many other DACA youth who are protected but are not work authorized, and so they will not, you know, those who do not have a diploma, who are not in school now, and probably will therefore not be able to get access to the training services that we're making available on the ground. And then we just have a much larger issue, which is that as we move the immigration reform and the workforce development conversations forward, they are actually operating on two different paths. So if you look at something even like the comprehensive immigration reform proposal that came through the Senate, the pathway to legalization required a lot of continuous employment, earnings gains, education and education achievement levels, and yet in order to get more people there, we're looking at for 11 million people who might be put on that pathway towards legalization. Their first stop is going to be that overused $570 million program for investments in adult basic ed that's barely serving 2 million people. So unless we can leverage some more resources out of what's happening in the context of the immigration reform discussion, we're both putting those immigrants as well as others in our country who are in need of those kinds of investments at risk. We've had some proposals about how we might want to do that, and I can share what some of those are. I think also we just have to think about how it is that we're valuing different types of education and training within the context of some immigration policies. We have a report that just came out, and my colleague Rachel Unruh, who's here in the audience today, was a co-author on what we call Missing in Action, using the example of the DREAM Act. So we are making it easier to protect young people who are in high school, moving into full-time college, or going into the military, but yet we know that per Demetra's point, a lot of times it's accelerated training, getting somebody into some kind of middle skill credential where there's immediate employability and decent wages. That is currently not a recognized, that you do not qualify for protection under the DREAM Act if that's the kind of education training that you're inclined to pursue. So we need to figure out how to include that as one of the ways that we're recognizing we can be investing in the skills of young immigrants in this country. And finally, on the issue of the role of the private sector, I mean, we are asking the business community and others to play a bigger role in how it is that they're thinking about their frontline workers, including the many low-skill immigrants who are currently working. The reality is that the private sector spends a tremendous amount of money on the training of workers. It just typically does not make it down to the frontline levels. So, you know, the White House is called to kind of challenge the business community to think about how to do that differently. And there are many businesses that are doing this already, but how can we take those best practices and lift them up to become more the rule, as opposed to the exception across a variety of different industries? We think that's going to be incredibly important. But we also think that at the end of the day, unless we have a much more substantial federal investment in these services, adult basic ed, ESL, VESL, that we are not going to be being able to move a substantial number of people towards some kind of decent skill level that's going to give them a chance to have a good job moving into the future.
Thank you very much, Andy. And I think none of us can complain about not getting enough information and facts. And what the opportunities are in addition to what the challenges are. So what I will try to do is sort of put some of that those questions into a more global context, some of which comes from the PIAAC study, you know, these 25 or so countries that that have been studied, that cooperated with the OECD and paid, you know, the OECD in order to conduct those studies. And others will talk about how we ought to be thinking about some of these challenges. My colleagues on the left, that has nothing to do with politics, my left, have discussed what the federal government is doing and hopes to be doing in that regard, and what the analytical community, you know, think tanks, etc., are doing to try to promote a certain set of ideas. So, you know, the study, the OECD big PIAAC study, has all sorts of different countries. And when I say different countries, I mean vastly different countries represented. From tiny Finland, no, I should say from Japan, that has less, or Korea, that have about 1% what I call immigrant density, in other words, proportion of the population that's foreign-born, you know, to places like Australia, that's almost 20%, 28%, or Canada, about 26%. And just in case you think that we are, you know, near the top or at the top, we're a middling country now in terms of immigrant density. You know, even places like Ireland, 21%, Sweden, almost 18%, Austria, 16.5%. In other words, whatever it is that we do, the numbers are big, but we're a large country. The fact is, you know, that others, you know, are having a much higher density, and unfortunately they're thinking much harder and investing more in trying to take care of some of these difficulties. And I think that all of us, the challenge is a challenge for all of the countries that were studied, for the entire OECD, call it for the entire high-income country universe. And the challenge is very simple. If we are in the immigration business so that we can waste human capital, we're doing great. I know it's a provocative way of saying this, because I want you to take one of those things, you know, the statement away with you. But if we're thinking hard and mean, when we say that competitiveness and economic growth, more so in the future as it has been in the back, relies on our ability to take full advantage of the human capital that we produce and that we take from other countries, then we really need to focus on this issue. Give you an example of how much human capital we take from the rest of the world. These 25 countries, between 2000 and 2013, there has been a 70% increase of people with tertiary education that have come to our countries. Almost doubling. Okay? 27 million people with tertiary degrees have emigrated to those 25 countries. We got to really think much harder about all of those things. And, you know, the findings, you know, probably reduce, and I'm exaggerating here, we don't have all the time in the world, into two sets of observations. The first one is that in most countries, immigrants tend to be more educated than natives in terms of the credentials that they have earned over there. But still, on average, they have lower levels of both literacy and numeracy. Okay, so we know what are the gaps, roughly, that we need to fill with smart policies. And when you control for different factors, for differences particularly in terms of the ability to speak the host language, country of destination, whatever it is that you want to call it, and control for the quality of education abroad, not all degrees were created equal, that still only explains about two-thirds of the variance. Second set of observations is throughout the 25 countries, and I suspect all high-income countries, immigrants have worse labor market outcomes, and the reason, the types of outcomes I'm referring to is employment, with the exception of the United States. If you look at how first and second generation of immigrants fare in many of the European countries, not by no means all of them, you will actually see vast gaps in employment, sometimes 2 and 2.5 times, not percent, times the employment for native-born. And, you know, we just finished a major project, released a whole bunch of papers that you might want to sort of look at, aiming higher policies to get immigrants into middle-skill work in Europe. And this is the final report, but under it there are about 12 reports that have gone into all of this. But it's not just employment, wages. Jana and Michael talked about, you know, lower wages. And a thing that really, really matters at the end of the day for this panel and for the health of the country and for immigrants themselves, and a topic that Michael and Jana have, you know, explored deeply and will continue to explore, and the Institute will continue to explore, is the underutilization of skills, what the OECD calls the overqualifications of workers. And I will say a bit more about that. Why are skills of the foreign-born underutilized? And this is, you know, an exercise in logic. All of it supported, of course, by findings that are emerging from looking at these issues and, you know, in all of the countries that have been studied. What are some of the key factors? Recognition of qualifications. It's a vast issue. Even more vast is the recognition of experiences. If you think it's difficult to try to figure out, you know, whether a degree in anything from country X will be recognized as a degree in a country Y, meaning the receiving country, the host country, experiences and tacit and soft skills, in other words, trades, master craftsmen, you know, master builders who come here and work in a low-wage, low-skilled job. That is a place where an awful lot of the waste of human capital takes place. Licensing exam difficulties, particularly due to language acquisition problems. I mean, if you really wanted to underline, you know, just everything that we're going to be talking about over the next years of how to take care of some of those issues, first and foremost, it comes down to language, language, language. If we don't get that, if we don't invest in that, and of course we're doing some smart things here, you know, sort of crosswalking between language and training, et cetera, and skills and all that, we're really not going to come in anywhere close to really creating opportunities for the people that we bring to our countries to succeed. And let's not forget that when immigrants succeed. We all do better. This has nothing to do about politics. It is about economics. Third one, you know, employers, let's be, you know, clear about this, are unwilling to accept government certifications and equivalences. The European Union has developed over the past decade and a half, a very robust set of standards for recognizing the qualifications of people who are from within the EU. Okay? And the fact remains, employers say, I don't care if you tell me that whatever someone who is an engineer in Greece, nothing, you know.
Yeah, right. Just
in Greece.
A little headline.
Can come and work in my highly organized, you know,
Greece,
place.
They're doing everything
they're
right.
They're doing everything right. That's it. That's the headline. And then discrimination of various forms. And this is very, very difficult. In the United States, we have much less of it. In the other 24 countries, you know, you have much, much more. In some places, like France, you have gigantic amounts of discrimination that have to do with ethnicity, background, race, religion, and the like. The lack of soft skills, the cultural kinds of things, you know, do they look like us? Do they talk like us? Can I trust them? These are the kinds of calculations, you know, that employers always make, particularly smaller employers. Big employers that have, you know, these highly articulated, you know, selection methods and departments that deal with HR, et cetera, you know, these, you know, perhaps are better at this. But when you get to the smaller employers or the ma and pa shops, you know, then discrimination goes much further. And in places like our own, where you have little regulated markets, I suspect, you know, some employers don't hesitate to discount some of those skills on purpose. You know, if you can pay, if you can get the same person, you know, for a bit of a discount, you know, why bypass this? So, you know, it is clear from all of this evidence, not just our own study of the U.S., that the returns to education acquired abroad and inadequate cost labor market information and experience lead to poor labor market outcomes. So we know what it is that we need to focus on, and you've heard some of the ways that we deal with that. And let me end with some policy lessons. I already mentioned language skills. You know, it may very well be the number one issue that we need to conquer. We need to, second, to improve the certification of skills and education. We need to find efficient and effective ways to bridge the gaps between what people bring in and what's required for them to be able to practice their profession. And I'm not talking necessarily about university professions, I'm talking about all of the other professions below the university level, all of the trades, etc., etc. And, you know, Demetra, thankfully, you know, I learned a lot from your presentation, but, you know, this emphasis on apprenticeships, organized formal apprenticeships, which is what most of the other smart countries are doing, and mentoring, another way that you can actually, you know, sort of bridge the gap between skills and better employment. Retraining and additional education that is targeted. You know, sometimes we make people have to get a degree from A to Z in the United States or in the other countries, while in reality they're missing a little bit of E and a little bit of M. Let's focus on that little part of E and little part of M in order to bring them up to snuff, as it were, this way that they can do better for their families and they can do better for all of us. Third, find ways to certify experience. That's extremely difficult. But for countries that get most of their immigrants from two or three places, and it's not us and Mexico and Central America, it's Germany and Turkey. In other words, there's always a diet. There are always two or three countries in all around that actually are responsible for a majority of all immigrants. Start thinking ahead. You know, how about if first we have their educational and training institutions certify what it is that these people bring along. And if that's not enough, let's start thinking about training people to similar and eventually common standards. It's not an impossible thing, but it takes effort and political muscle. The final one is refining the immigrant selection process. And here is where, you know, things get a bit messy and difficult. In order to address some of these issues, directly or indirectly, countries have come up with different initiatives. And we all know intuitively what it is that they are. In countries that select a part of their immigrants on the basis of some sort of a point system, in other words, you know, looking at attributes and valuing these attributes, emphasizing language and prior experience in that country, somebody who has worked, in other words, on a short-term or longer-term temporary visa, get an awful lot of emphasis in the point system, and that's a smart thing. The second one is something that we have, you know, done forever, and more countries are doing today, which is get the employers to do much of the choosing. You know, create parameters within which they're going to, you know, operate, you know, whether it's wages, whether it's how many, et cetera, et cetera. But if you don't want to waste skills up front, okay, have employers choose the skills that they need and the people who have those skills. A third one, everybody's doing that. We're trying to do this thing here. Create easier opportunity pathways for foreign-born students who are graduating from our universities. And that's a difficult issue because, you know, if you look at it purely from, you know, that's a great opportunity for us. You know, you have to worry at least a little bit, you know, about what does it mean for the countries that have sent, because an awful lot of those students are here with scholarships from their own governments. And the final one, testing and certifying skills and education prior to even coming into our own countries. In other words, you know, if you have, if you say that you have a degree or a skill, certify before you come. And in case you think this is impossible, now you cannot apply for a visa in Canada or in Australia until you've done that. Which means then you create a new industry that whose business is to certify, to understand those skills and experience and certify those things. Not a bad way to proceed. You know, this is not going to be something that's going to be a magic sword, et cetera, et cetera. So, finally, the immigrant selection formula matters a lot, but facilitating the labor market integration of those whom you admit matters even more. Thank you. And now, I know you've all formulated your questions. And I will open the floor to questions. Please wait for a microphone to reach you. Lisa is there with a microphone. Speak into the microphone because all of this thing is recorded, etc. So we need to know what the question is in order for us to answer them. Please identify yourselves for the show.
My name is Ellen Street, and I work for DSF Consulting. We do professional development for ESL teachers. And I'm working outside of DSF. I'm working with an Afghan immigrant. He's a lawyer in Afghanistan, but he came over here, and now he's having a really hard time finding a job and getting acclimated. He's been here about 6 months. So what are we doing to help the people that are highly skilled that have come over here for asylum that aren't necessarily graduating from college but still have high skills?
Asking me, are you addressing this to a specific person?
No, sir, I think that you address that issue the most, but if anyone has any comments on it, I'd be very grateful.
Either of you? Michael?
Although I'll start, because just because someone needs to. It seems to me that this issue has been addressed principally not by public sector, but by the civil society institutions in the United States. And it's by a fairly small number of civil society institutions in the United States that you may be aware of. The best model is probably the Welcome Back program, which works with professionals principally in the health area. And what it does is it takes professionals who may have been doctors or who may have been scientists in their home countries. And in the U.S., it doesn't necessarily try to get them at jobs as doctors, but it tries to get them jobs in the health industry on pathways where they can eventually become doctors. It teaches them the technical professional language while they're here in the United States. It offers an adapted curriculum. They're fairly widely spread. There are 7 or 8 of them across the United States. The other organization that we've worked with in the past, and we've actually awarded integration awards to each of these two organizations, is the Upwardly Global program, which is in New York. York and Chicago and San Francisco. It works more broadly with professionals, and its model is much more what Dimitri suggested, which is a mentoring model. So they get professionals to work with other professionals and teach them such things like the application process, soft skills, and the like.
Also, and those programs are critically important, especially because they're, as Michael said, they're non-governmental organizations. And as long as the individuals are here with a work visa, they can certainly help. And a number of them are partnering with some of the publicly funded programs around apprenticeship. And every year, more and more occupations are being included in the registered apprenticeship process. I don't think lawyers are yet in that category, but I wrote it down to see if we can check on that. And there aren't enough of those programs around, and they don't necessarily serve a whole lot of people. So we don't have a lot of hard data on what happens in those programs. But the more active the programs become and the more engaged they are with the public workforce system, then maybe we may start accumulating more information, which will help us in the public policy world try to promote sort of access into those organizations. But there are a number of those organizations around the country. That's what I would do, is send them to those.
It's a tough area, but Europeans have found a lot of success through the apprenticeship programs. In other words, same thing that we do with engineers. You know, in firms, there are only a few professional engineers. They're the ones who sign off and they're responsible for what it is that is being produced. But an awful lot of the engineers under them tend to be foreign-born. They're engineers, their credentials perhaps are not fully recognized, but they work in their field. Same thing, you know, with lawyers. They can work in a law firm in a lower capacity until they gain enough experience to be able to take the bar.
Right. I should also mention, we've talked about apprenticeship a while, and I think right now there is an opened grant application for apprenticeship programs, the American Apprenticeship Program, which will have, I think, $100 million for apprenticeship programs. And one of the purposes of that is to really not only expand some of the traditional registered apprenticeship, but to think more creatively in partnership with industries and with organizations and with the workforce and education system to expand that opportunity, because we have good evidence in the U.S. and even better evidence in other countries about the importance and the value of apprenticeship for career advancement.
Thank you. So I have Alan and this lady over there. So if you have a question, please raise your hand and I will, okay? Alan, please.
I'm a non-resident fellow of MPI, and I teach history at American University.
My question is, first, to thank the panel for a splendid presentation. One of the cultural stereotypes that's kind of on the street is that the last chronological period you discussed is shaped to some extent by South Asian immigrants, immigrants coming out of China, who have already received education, who have, in some cases, language difficulties, but in other cases, not so much, and are basically boosting the success rate within that period. And I was wondering if you did, in the course of your study, a national and a regional breakdown for all of the chronological periods.
We were very perplexed by that finding, that there was no difference in skills by period of arrival. Due to the data limitation, we were not able to look at the regions of origin of immigrants. So we did look at education, and education levels were higher of the most among the most recent arrivals. But it's definitely a great suggestion. We can look at race and ethnicity, maybe not the origin specific, but at least the looking at the race and ethnicity.
Just looking at the skill level, Alan, what was striking was both for Hispanics and for Asians was the stunning growth in skills between the immigrant generation and the population as a whole. And then this point that Jean has pointed out, which is that we were really surprised that the increase, if you will, in the skills of immigrants arriving during the recession, that there was seemed to be a whole different selection process going on. It's intuitive, but you know, intuitions are often wrong.
Thank you, Michael. Would you please identify yourself? Thank you.
Sure. My name is Stacy. I work for Casa de Maryland, which is an organization that works directly with immigrants, and most of those immigrants have a very low level of education. And it's really hard to work with them because it's not only the English literacy, sometimes they don't have even the Spanish literacy. So one of my questions is, if when you were doing your research, is you asked them what was the level of education that these people that came here for the first time has, because we have found out that most of them have almost just elementary school, and they never practice again. So sometimes they just forget how to write and read, and they have difficulty talking to. So if we need to address that, and I want to hear for the panel if we are doing something regarding that. My other question is for professionals like me. I have a PhD in economy, and I'm a researcher. And when I came here for the first time, it was really hard for me to navigate the system. So it's not easy sometimes. So that what she was asking is really important. If we can have mentoring, will be great, because we know a lot of things, but we don't know exactly how the system works, exactly where we should go and what to do. So because of my Michael's researches, I went on internet and, you know, was trying to find everything there. And finally, I knew that I have to send my degrees somewhere to be recognized here and all the stuff. And then how to give an interview, how to write a resume, because it's different. We come from another culture. And I found a very great mentoring from the Small Business Administration, but it's more like if you want to open a business, which is great too, but you need the capital for that. But, you know, to be, you know, mentoring more for professional people. Thank you.
And Michael or Jana, and then I don't know if someone else from the panel wants to address this issue.
What you raised about the literacy levels in immigrants' own language is extremely, extremely important, because you can't build a literacy in English without solid literacy and skills in their own, in your own language. And unfortunately, PIAAC tests only people in English, but it doesn't ask people question how literate you are. It doesn't assess or even ask how literate you are in your own language. So we know that people who were not able to answer a questionnaire in English or Spanish, their background questionnaire, they were excluded from the sample. So my guess is that many people who were excluded fall into that category. And as to you, the second question, the operatively global, as a, right now a more of, it becomes more of a national organization. I remember that they developed for 10 professions. I'm not sure if economics is one of them, but for 10 professions, they developed a step-by-step process of how to navigate the licensing and other requirements, because you're absolutely right. You face a sea of information. It will vary depending on which state you live, what kind of profession you want to practice, where do you start, and how do you fill those small gaps in the education that you already have with what's required. So for it, there was already some work done for some professions for certain states, but clearly there is a need to create these navigation systems for a variety of occupations in different states.
Okay, Michael, you said you had a word or two.
I believe the way we broke it out in our report is that we classify people with less than a high school education. Is that correct? but we didn't really go underneath that to see how many had very few years of education. And so that might be something we might want to look back at as we look back at the data, because the PIAAC will let us do that. Mm-hmm. So I think that makes I'm worried that a significant number, that some share of them will have been excluded for the reasons that Jana pointed out, but I think it's an important an additional layer of analysis that we should try.
Thank you.
I wanted to add one point because I learned this in Casa de Maryland, where I've done a little bit of work, but in other programs around the country. And going back again to the second and third generation, often what we hear, and programs don't always know this in advance, for the second and third generation, we have a huge human capital potential that is being underutilized, particularly if they have some facility in more than one language. So we know in some labor markets, having facility and fluency in more than one language is critical. So where there are training programs, for example, that are trying to increase the supply of bilingual workers in whatever occupation or industry that it might be, what some programs are finding is that some of those second and third generation are not fully fluent in either language. They may be able to understand and operate in a second language, but their facility is not high enough. So we need to integrate both sort of the function. If we want more bilingual or trilingual workers, which we do as a nation, we need to simultaneously raise the literacy level in two or three languages for the second and third generation. No small challenge, but there are programs around the country that are trying to do that.
Thank you. We have two questions. We'll take them. You're next, and, well, it makes no difference. We'll take both questions, and whatever we can't answer during the actual session, we'll have a conversation by you walking up to the panel.
Thank you so much for organizing this event. My name is Hadi Abdul-Sattar, and I represent Upwardly Global. And thank you so much for mentioning my organization several times. I guess my question would be for Dimitra. I read a lot about WIOA, and I was wondering what the government can do for nonprofit organizations such as Upwardly Global when it comes to assisting with recertification or certification of immigrants, or when it comes to federal investment into these kind of nonprofit organizations. Thank you.
Didivi, that's it.
Thank you. My name is Roger Vital. I'm with the Maryland State Department of Labor, and I, since, 5 years, I've been leading their program for new Americans. So a lot of what you've talked about here has been on our agenda for our new American populations. Of course, I've had experience working with members of CASA and Upwardly Global and so forth, and Michael. But what I wanted to say more specifically, also, by the way, thank you for making me a member of MBI. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder how many people here are really even become a member of MBI. That's a great opportunity. The WIA Title I, of course, is looking at training. And WIA Title II, Section 202, has specific requirement to workforce agencies to provide and assist LEP youth members and adults in obtaining the skills and competency, I guess, for economic viability. What about when you, Demetria, talked about WIOA? Has it somewhat replaced WIA, all the WIA requirements?
I'm sorry, it seems that you're the favorite target of the questions.
Okay.
But we are over time, so
First I'll start with the second. And the Labor Department, the Employment and Training Administration, has websites that you can go to get sort of the summaries of the WIOA. It doesn't totally replace. It is reauthorization of the Workforce Investment Act. So the new The new name of the act is WIOA. Many of the titles will remain the same. There will be new guidance. So the big change will be in terms of the alignment of the programs across each other. At the local level, you may not immediately see a lot of changes because the system, the local offices, the agencies will remain the same. What we hope to see is a shift in focus and direction and inclusion of different programs and alignment and blending across the programs. Which relates, I think, to the nonprofits. The Labor Department, the Education Department, the White House are very much interested in expanding the role of non-governmental and nonprofit organizations in the system. There are, and as Andy said, the allocation under the formula programs, which includes WIOA now and Adult Ed, is not going up. So the funds are not going up there. The opportunity, I think, is to look at federal grant options that are available. And so I mentioned the $100 million grants that are available for the apprenticeship program. There are also billions of dollars going to be already available and about to be available for a whole range of training programs, many of which are being done jointly with the Labor Department and Education. The eligibility for those grant programs is much broader, and certainly nonprofit organizations should probably partner with their public workforce agency, which we hope will be easier to do now and in the future than it has been in the past. But we want to encourage you to reach out to your local workforce agencies and also keep your eye on federal grant opportunities.
Thank you very much, Demeter. And I will ask our president to have the last word and close the session.
Well, you invite your friends and colleagues to come share with others, but sometimes you just learn so much from them. I've learned a ton today, and I really appreciate these presentations. They've all been just fantastic. And I really appreciate your coming and hope you'll come again soon. So with that, we're over.
For more information, visit the Migration Policy Institute at www.migrationpolicy.org.